This episode of Section D was first broadcast on the 14th of October 2014 on Monocle 24. Section D is brought to you in association with Grundig. Hello and welcome to Section D, the hour we devote to the world of design each week here on Monocle 24. I'm your host, Tom Morris. Coming up today, we're taking to the skies to discuss design in the air. First up, we meet the editor of a sumptuous new compendium dedicated to the golden age of well-designed air travel.
That is one of the symbols that is completely fascinating to me, because even though Pan Am has been out of business since 1991, everyone still recognizes this logo.
Then I meet the men behind a whole new product design proposition for serving food on board.
Why doesn't my food kind of taste like where I've just been? Or that notion that it shouldn't stop at the gate. Your journey goes the whole way.
And then we head on that very aeroplane to Belgrade for Design Week.
They wanted to put Belgrade down to the rivers, which is illusion. I mean, that will be so private and capital-owned that you could not just use the river.
That's all here on Section D with me, Tom Morris, on Monocle 24. To start the show, let's take to the skies. If there's one subject that deserves some very serious investment in print, then airline visuals it is. From Air France to Tahiti, Swiss Air to Sao Paulo, the posters and merchandise of what is undisputably the golden age of air travel are in themselves a precious resource of unparalleled design heritage. Airline Visual Identity, 1945 to 1975, published by Callisto, is probably the most beautiful and comprehensive book ever to be made on the subject. A coffee table book par excellence, if your coffee table is big enough. With a price tag of just under €300, it's an investment in print of the highest quality. To look at some of the iconic logos, ad campaigns and boarding cards that made it into the book, Monocle's David Pleasant spoke to the author Matthias Sihuna and airline by airline discussed air travel's enduring visual appeal.
I thought this book was going to communicate to its readers the great care that was taken in the 1940s, 50s, 60s and 70s by the airline industry to market their services. And I discovered this topic a few years ago while I was in Paris, and I saw one of the beautiful old Air France posters as an original in a gallery. And I've always had a great interest in corporate design history, and thought that a book that really brings the original quality that was done at the time to the reader in combination with a lot of research might be of interest.
The level of research is quite extraordinary. With the airlines that you've covered, it's comprehensive. I imagine that there's not a, you haven't missed a poster or a piece of corporate branding for any of these airlines. Was there a lot of archive research and kind of digging around all these different companies across the world? I mean, how was that process?
That's a very good question, because in fact, I found as part of the research that many companies over the course of time discarded parts of their corporate archives because they didn't have enough space and they thought it was no longer relevant. So it was actually in some cases quite a puzzle to collect these various items that you see in the book. But some airlines have very good archives. One of them would be British Airways or Lufthansa or Air France, and they were quite helpful.
But perhaps Aeroflot, was that more challenging?
That was very challenging, if only for language reasons.
Right. And let's talk about the importance of the corporate identity of these airlines and how influential really it has been. Why do you think now is the time that we need this book? You know, do you feel we're missing something? Do you think we should go back to that age in some way?
Some people have commented in this direction. I personally just wanted to show it the way it was and didn't want to make a statement that times today are not as good as they were back then, because obviously back then flying was a much more exclusive matter and it was limited to relatively few people, and today it is much more accessible to everyone, so there are advantages and disadvantages to that, obviously.
the first passenger jet clipper to fly the Atlantic. Because of its greater size and speed, it will do the job of several of the biggest propeller-driven planes. Near sonic speed, but inside, one of the most stunning discoveries. There is no feeling of movement at all. No vibration, hardly any sound. A new concept in air transportation. The travail has been taken out of travel.
Pan Am, after World War II, had already been established as the leading international airline by far at that point in time. And they were also a leader in terms of their presentation, their advertising materials, and their whole appearance toward the customers. So, of course, Pan American in the 1950s, like most of the other airlines at that time, when they created a campaign, they hired various artists, they hired advertising agencies, and because they were doing this on a global scale and they had to reach different markets on a global scale already in that early period of the 1940s and 50s, it's quite exciting to see how they did that. Later, Pan Am, of course, created the famous globe, the blue globe with the Pan Am logo on top of it, in the 1950s, because they were anticipating the jet aircraft that were due to arrive in the late 1950s. That is one of the symbols that is completely fascinating to me, because even though Pan Am has been out of business since 1991, everyone still recognizes this logo.
And yeah, it has a big cultural impact, really, kind of beyond corporate business. I mean, how can you kind of trace that? Do you think it was the right designers? I mean, it was kind of quite revolutionary, really, for the time.
It was. And Pan Am was a leader in how they approached corporate design in the airline industry. A lot of airlines at that time did not have a very comprehensive approach to their visual identity. It was sort of split up in many small campaigns. And Pan Am, maybe because they were on an international scale and most of the American airlines, for example, at that time were mostly domestic airlines, they really had a high level of professionalism and they were so famous, everyone knew them. So probably a lot of factors contributed to making this particular logo and this particular design so lasting.
Charles, emmenez-moi. Demandez-moi.
Air France, demandez-moi. Air France always took great care in associating the airline as a national carrier to the qualities of France itself, as an ambassador of culture, as an ambassador of the French lifestyle. And as a result, they carefully chose who they worked with for their campaigns. They used artists. A lot of the other airlines only, quote unquote, used graphic artists, commercial artists, while Air France used very well-established artists like Victor Vasarely and others. And they contributed to creating this image that Air France has even today as a very cultivated airline.
It means the way we care for you, both in the air and once you're here.
British Airways could take more care of you.
British Airways, of course, is a fascinating story of a carrier who was created out of the Imperial Airlines. The worldwide reach of Imperial was already quite comparable to Pan American prior to World War II. And two airlines with a beautiful range of designs and campaigns merged to create British Airways in 1973. One was BOAC and the other was British European Airlines.
And if we can finally kind of sum up perhaps some of the lasting influences, that the legacy of this fantastic period of the golden age, really, of corporate identity for the airline industry. I know at the beginning of the interview you said you didn't really want to dwell on any kind of comment on whether design has kind of gone downhill since then. But do you think there's some kind of lessons that we can look at and perhaps some reference points for modern airlines, for modern companies to kind of develop their own identity still?
I would say so. I think taking great care of a company's identity always pays off. And the examples that we show in this book have been supported by statistics. We also wanted to provide some background to the reader and so he can see if the airline was doing well when they changed a corporate design or the airline was doing not so well. But in the end, I think this book also shows how much care was taken, and it is always a good idea to invest a lot of attention to the appearance.
That was David Pleasant speaking to Matthias Sihuna on the launch of his book, Airline Visual Identity, 1945 to 1975, published by Callisto. Now we're going to stay on the design of air travel and discuss one slightly neglected aspect of it. We're all too familiar with the bland, visually unappetizing tray of plastic-encased fodder that greets us on any long-haul flight with the accompanying chicken or pasta. It's safe to say that few find a meal in the sky to be anything other than unnecessary evil. But Martin Posler and Ian Ferguson of London design firm Posler Ferguson want to change this. They've teamed up with the well-loved boutique coffee, food and wine chain Fernandez and Wells to create slick wooden containers, specially designed to accommodate the cafe's menu and potentially that mile-high menu. That better packaged might be more appealing.
Basically, what our first concept was about, the Brotzeit concept a couple of years ago, was about to reduce any sort of trash and to actually take your food on the plane with you. So the whole idea was like you go to an airport, you purchase a ticket. With that ticket comes, you know, sort of choice of food. And you could go to like, you know, the British Airways food court, pick your thing, take it on the plane, give it to a stewardess and then get it handed back later when you, if it has to be warmed up or not even. So it's like the classic travel food idea, you know, no matter what country you're in, there's always this kind of one thing, which is like the classic travel food, like, you know, the bento box, the Brotzeit in Germany, like the Smörgåsbröd, or, you know, kind of sandwich picnic kind of idea. And I think it's kind of weird that that doesn't exist for something like air travel in a way, because that's a very constrained environment. Yeah, so the whole point was that you actually take something on board and pretty much hand it back afterwards. So you know, you have some sort of packaging that is like a lunchbox. You eat, hand it back, you don't have any waste, because I think that's kind of like what we really, besides the food quality, but that's something that annoys us the most, is like you end up with this like ridiculous amount of
stuff,
of volume on this tiny little thing, you know, this tiny little tray.
So could you tell us, describe to our listener what we're looking at here, these sort of amazing little wooden trinket boxes, aren't they?
Yeah, exactly. So everything was kind of, in this case, designed around the Fernandez and Wells menu. So looking at all the items of food they have, which are all things that are kind of served cold and have quite shelf-stable, last a long time, and have quite nice, intense flavors. So what we have is little standard bamboo boxes, each one slightly sized to fit the kind of thing that's going to go in it. So everything from a sandwich to our sardines to olives, you know what I mean? I think it was quite nice that actually we tried to not make anything too crazy this time. You know, this is packaging that's not crazily obscure. You can source these kind of things and find the right sizes, and the food is all there, but it's just it's actually the way that you orchestrate it and bring it together and put it together so that it's all quite nice. And everything was done looking at like kind of the constraints of what can you bring on an airplane, you know, like the volume that you can bring on, looking at like making sure we select stuff that you don't break that 100 milliliter liquid layer and everything. And so that each one of these, because they're quite nice and you're probably going to carry it from South Kent to the airport, you know, we wanted to also make sure that it wasn't, that it feels quite good to pick up and put in your bag and kind of get sold together. So the idea is kind of like at Fernandez as well, is they could have these packaged up and then you kind of get it bound together.
Yeah. Why bamboo in particular?
I think in this case, we wanted something that was warm and nice and not plastic, that also suited the kind of Fernandez and Wells aesthetic. They have a very nice kind of earthy, very real feeling, something with some texture rather than plastic, and looks nice. And it has the potential, you know, to be printed on quite nicely, to do a lot with kind of graphics and simple things to make it feel really special. And then we can line it. So depending on what goes in there, we can line it with different materials and make it so that it comes together quite neatly. And when it's done, you don't want to, it doesn't have that crumpled piece of tinfoil feel to it, you know.
Sorry, piece of plastic in
there. Yeah, the thing that you don't want to touch because like the slimy bit is turned inside out or something. So everything goes together really neatly.
Yeah. What I'm most interested in is the actual sort of labeling of it, which you've kind of very worked in the world of airline livery and that sort of thing. We've got slightly Lufthansa Pantone used here. How did, you know, trying to work with the traditions of aircraft design influence how you actually did the labeling?
This is mostly part of that show, actually, because we had actually installed all the packaging on like a poster kind of format. So we made like two A1 sized kind of sheets. One has the packaging on it and the other one has like a sort of, almost like a collage of like three-dimensional things. So we actually 3D printed cutlery, we 3D printed kind of signage. So what we wanted to do is, of course, in that kind of square, to get people in. You know what I mean? This was the original motivation by Fernandez and Wells, to be part of the London Design Festival, to actually get people into the shop and let them have a look at what's in there and then also, like, you know, have a drink. So this is also coming originally, especially that, like, a Lufthansa kind of
which I love.
Yeah, I mean, this is, you know, it can't get more airline than that, you know, in a way. So we wanted that people kind of very, very clearly saw, oh, there's something unusual going on in that shop. And we made it like a very, very big vinyl cut on that window in front of it. It was like a big Boeing Dreamliner outline and so forth. So there clearly something's going on in there.
And if this comes to pass and these sort of get beyond prototype stage, will you continue with this sort of color range, or do you think it will modify and develop beyond it?
I quite like to continue. Funny enough, there's one wall in that particular Brompton one actually has that kind of orange. Mm. So it's like everything is, you know, natural material, wood and so forth, and then black and white. But they have that kind of, that's the only color dot. And yeah, I think that could actually work very well.
And the kind of the tension between the clean sans serif airline graphics and then this kind of bamboo box, which is kind of softened and round. So I think in the context of that shop, which again is really lovely and rustic and warm, we wanted to make sure there was one little edge to this that also let you realize it's for travel. There's a definite aesthetic to travel. And you know, anyone who's walked through many international airports looking at all the signs, you're very familiar with this kind of typeface and this sort of layout. And I think it kind of helps people understand what it is.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I guess in a way, it's sort of using design to sort of retrain, completely overhaul where the kind of flight experience starts, which is usually, you know, beyond your gate. And I think particularly if you're, you know, doing a long flight, you sort of buy a Pret or whatever in the airport, even if that, or you just sort of sit down, you're, you know, expect to be served. Whereas actually you're using kind of, eye-grabbing packaging to actually start it on the journey to the airport.
Yeah, and especially in a place like London, like such a world city, and you know, and we tend to fly from world city to world city to world city. And in that case, I think the whole like kind of narrative of travel, you know, should extend out from the airport. It shouldn't begin after the check-in gate. You know, it's kind of your whole trip. I mean, that was one of the first starting points for this entire idea of the project. You know, like, why doesn't my food kind of taste like where I've just been? Or like I'm on the plane back and I was like, oh man, I really wish I could have another noodle soup from leaving Hong Kong, you know, like rather than this, you know. So I think that notion that, that it shouldn't stop at the gate, it should, your journey goes the whole way.
That was me talking to Martin Possler and Ian Ferguson of London design firm Possler Ferguson about their new concept for food packaging on board aeroplanes.
For over six decades, Grundig has made people's lives better and simpler. To this day, we bring our expert knowledge of design and technology to a wide range of high-quality domestic appliances. Whether refrigerator or radio, oven or audio system, we continue to integrate our manufacturing heritage with state-of-the-art technology. Grundig synthesizes the best of yesterday with the best of tomorrow, expertly and innovatively designed for you and your home. Grundig, supreme engineering, timeless design.
Now, the Swiss watch industry is one that tick-tocks along famously reliably, with many of the brands sticking to what they do and attempting to do it better, rather than inventing new items unnecessarily. And that makes a recent launch by esteemed horological manufacturer, IWC, even more important. It has recently premiered its first move into the women's watch market with the rather gorgeous Portofino mid-size watch. IWC CEO George Kern was recently in London to mark the launch and also show his support of the BFI London Film Festival. I caught up with him to discuss the Portofino midsize and also the brand's long-established relationship with the silver screen.
It's the launch of the Portofino midsize, which is basically an enlargement of a very successful line, obviously called the Portofino. And this product is targeted to smaller wrists, or to put it bluntly, to women. So it's a big watch for women.
And a big launch for you to be sort of moving into this territory.
It's a very new territory, at least considering what we have done in the last 10, 15 years. But I think it's a very natural move now that we are a very mature brand, we're very established. And we had, since many years, so many requests to produce and offer smaller watches, as anyway, women love our brand. We estimate that 25% of our products sold are to women who prefer having men-sized watches or big watches.
So how are you marking the launch creatively? I know you've got a fantastic photography exhibition that you've worked on?
Yeah, the first time we're actually launching a product only through public relations and social media, so no advertising. And we've decided to have a photo shoot with Peter Lindbergh, who is one of the most profiled photographers on that planet, and to have an amazing cast with Cate Blanchett, Emily Blunt, Ewan McGregor, Christoph Waltz, and a Chinese star called Zhu Xun. And we have an amazing exhibition now traveling around the world featuring these stars with this watch. And, well, it's all over. We had the launch in Zurich and in Hong Kong with Cate Blanchett, and today with Emily Blunt and with Christoph Waltz. And, yeah, you will see these pictures all over.
And you're also here for the opening of the London Film Festival. I wondered what, if you could tell me a bit about the relationship between IWC and the silver screen.
Well, there's a kind of natural, intrinsic link between IWC and the film business, because in our days, you don't sell a watch simply with a function. You need to create a dream, an emotion around the product. And we are, in a way, storytellers. And the best storytellers in the world are filmmakers and actors. And they generate dreams. And Hollywood is a dream factory, in a way. So it's why we have been involved since many, many years, not only through product placements or associations with talents, but we support the Beijing Film Festival, Tribeca, Zurich, Dubai, and now the London Film Festival.
And you're also here to, I guess, start or midway through preparations for first London flagship, aren't you?
That's absolutely right. We're very fortunate, finally, to have a spot on New Bond Street. It took us a while because, as you can imagine, it's very expensive. And we have been very fortunate to find a very good location. So we'll soon be ready, hopefully by beginning of December, mid of December, to have a home of our brand here in London at New Bond Street.
As this is a design show, Monocle 24, could you tell us any ideas of what we can expect the store to look like?
It is very typical. It will be very typical also from the exterior to that portion of New Bond Street. You know, the restrictions are there in terms of architecture, but we could find agreement. And the decoration inside obviously is very specific, I mean, IWC style, but you have to adapt your style to any situation. And here it will be beautiful, very modern, contemporary, but with areas where we tell our stories, be it for the pilot's watches or the Portuguese or the diver's watches. So that's the advantage of a boutique, that you have space to feature your products, but also to tell a story around and to illustrate the products in your decoration.
From a sort of business side or a strategy point of view, I guess London is more important than ever for a brand like yours.
It is true. We hope that there will be many more Chinese tourists coming to London. Today, we, accordingly to the figures, we have 500,000 Chinese tourists coming per year to London, but we have 2 million in Paris, for instance. So it's all a question of visas and agreements through Schengen. And we hope that this tourism from Asia will increase, because this is very important for the luxury industry as a whole.
As a sign off, I was wondering, I mean, you're sort of one of the youngest of all the CEOs. How would you sort of state where IWC sort of sits in the landscape of the Swiss watch industry?
I mean, we have been evolving strongly over the last 12 years. We had very successful years. We're very happy about that. I think, you know, when you build a maison like ours, it's very much also about stomach feeling and to develop the right products with the right design at the right moment. And we have been quite successful in doing this. Today, IWC combines modernism, we're a very contemporary brand, with traditional watchmaking. I think our products are extremely tasteful, and it's never, wearing an IWC is never a mistake in any occasion. And this is what I say to many people. It's really the ultimate good taste product in the watch industry.
That was Georges Kern, CEO of Swiss watch brand IWC, talking to me there. You're listening to Monocle 24 with me, Tom Morris, where I'm bringing you Section D, our dedicated design show. Still to come today, we'll be going to New York, where plans emerged to stop the city from submerging. We'll be talking type in South London and going to Belgrade, where new designs are upsetting many in the city.
You're listening to Section D with me, Tom Morris. In 2012, the world watched as Hurricane Sandy wreaked havoc on America's largest city. New Yorkers were left with destroyed homes, wasted businesses, flooded tunnels, and submerged subways. The Hurricane Sandy Rebuilding Task Force, a Department of Housing and Urban Development, set about gathering the knowledge, expertise, and local opinion in an effort to ensure that this kind of devastation would be averted in the future. In September this year, almost exactly 2 years after Hurricane Sandy visited Manhattan's shores, 6 winning proposals were announced. One was a multi-use seawall, whose U-shape will hold back the storm surge should a megastorm ever happen. Monocle's Nick Wager spoke to Kai-Uwe Bergman, a business partner at winning firm BIG, or Bjarke Ingels Group.
The BIG U is a protective system for Lower Manhattan, which stretches from on the west side 57th Street down to the Battery and then north to 42nd Street. It was conceived in the wake of Hurricane Sandy as part of a competition with the federal government, the Department of Housing and Urban Development. And essentially we were asked to look at the region and look at where the opportunities were to combine design with resiliency as a project. And so we really quickly zoomed in on Lower Manhattan and New York City as a place that is very dense, very urban, and also very, very threatened by repeated storms and climate events. And so the Big U, this 10-mile geography, basically follows the line of fill that the Dutch sort of began in the 17th century with this program of land reclamation. They sort of tried to concentrate land mass towards the harbor, where all of the port activities were, and that provided for a lot of kind of economic opportunity and real estate. But on the other hand, a lot of that fill was built at about 6 feet above mean sea level. So the Big U kind of retraces this geography. That's where it gets its name. And it is sort of built on this idea of social infrastructure. If you think about the High Line is an infrastructure which was in use for many years. It was at a certain point decommissioned and turned into a park. This new public layer of program was placed on top. And it's now, the High Line Park, which is an insanely successful thing for the city and, you know, really a significant public space.
In terms of the High Line Park, is there a dynamic competition there?
I wouldn't say that there's a competition with the High Line. I think in some ways, though, we are, you know, trying to learn from the High Line, and actually we've kind of dubbed it the Dry Line, sort of an elevated public park that takes the form of many different things, landscape, public art, urban furniture, even buildings that collectively sort of link together along the New York City coastline to form a protective barrier that keeps the water out from the river, so that when we have events like Hurricane Sandy in the future, we'll be better protected. But at the same time, that infrastructure is also acting as a social infrastructure. It acts as a platform for people and for public life and for activity along the waterfront.
In terms of activity for the people of New York, the project has segments. Could you illustrate more on the segments of the project?
Sure. So although we call it the Big U, in some ways we realize pretty quickly that to do 10 miles of continuous coastal protection in one go poses a lot of challenges. So actually we began to conceive of it as a series of little U's, and those little U's each follow the scale of something more like a neighborhood or a community. We found that as you move along the coastline, the conditions, the physical conditions vary greatly. Sometimes you have a highway, sometimes it's elevated, sometimes it's at grade, sometimes you can cross it. There's a whole different variety of physical conditions, but also a whole different variety of neighborhoods and communities with completely different characters. So we realized that also on that level, on the level of design, that the Big U would really have to respond to these different neighborhoods. And so we broke it up into what we call compartments, a little bit like the hull of a ship. If you think about the hull of a ship, it has these separations that keep the boat dry, basically. And so the Big U is also compartmentalized. That means that you can build each of these compartments in one go. It is self-contained and protects the neighborhood and that portion of the floodplain. And then it can also be designed in conjunction with the communities that lie upland from those discrete pieces of infrastructure.
And I noticed, in comparison to the work done in New Orleans after Katrina, they had huge levees that they constructed. What was the inspiration behind changing that and going with a slope design?
Yeah, so we actually took a trip to New Orleans, us together with, you know, other firms we were working with and other firms doing parallel projects as part of this competition, and also with people from HUD, the federal government. And, you know, we saw that, you know, there really was an urgency after Hurricane Katrina to rebuild the infrastructure such that the city could protect itself. But at the same time, we saw a lot of lost opportunities, given that so many resources, so much time, so much investment is put into these kind of protective infrastructures like levees and seawalls, and that these pieces of infrastructure really abut communities directly. You know, they're right in the middle of a residential neighborhood. The relationship that these concrete walls basically have to the surrounding homes and to the parks that they lie in is really non-existent. So what we really wanted to do was make the protective infrastructure anything but a wall. One way, one very simple illustration was a segment that we called the Big Bench, where we simply, you know, transformed this wall into a bench that you can sit on, and then that bench in turn kind of transformed into a series of other things like auditorium seating, bike points, playground equipment. So that's one way that you can turn sort of a dumb flood wall into something that's actually contributing to the neighborhood. But we also found that there were a lot of opportunities where New York City's coast is actually occupied by park. Some of those parks, like the one you find on the East River Park, are quite large. You know, they're a mile and a half long. But on the other hand, there's not a lot of green space. It's very heavily programmed with basketball courts and tennis courts and things. So what we really heard from community members was that something green that could contribute to the ecology of the neighborhood, that could provide for more kind of unprogrammed green space, could be a great thing. It also, you know, breaks up a wall visually and is really kind of a nice addition to a park. It provides topography that gives you views. And even in the case of the East River Park berm, the topography allows you to create ramps that bring you up to bridges that bring you over the highway, so that this, what would be a wall separating people from the water, actually becomes something that enables people to get to the waterfront.
So now that they're able to get to the waterfront and as a community come together, how did you scope out the needs and lifestyles of the people that this space can cater to?
So we realized really early on that to try and design, so we kind of limited our focus scope to half of the Big U, a 5 mile stretch from 23rd Street down to the Battery. And it was really clear that, you know, we could get to a certain point as designers, but we also needed to understand, you know, what the conditions were on the ground and, you know, how these places were used. At the same time, we sort of had a mandate from the federal government to do an in-depth community engagement process. And as we brainstormed what to do, we came into contact with a few groups, most notably a group on the Lower East Side called Lower East Side Ready. Lower East Side Ready was formed as an umbrella organization for over 25 member organizations on the Lower East Side, formed to plan around disaster preparedness and response. And they wanted to start thinking about long-term planning, and that's sort of a role we were able to help them with. So we kind of approached it as designers and said, okay, this is the situation. If you're going to be building a protective infrastructure, it can take a couple of different forms. It can be a deployable element, it can be a sort of a concrete flood wall, or it can be more of a wide landscape element. And given those three types, there's a whole bunch of ingredients that you can mix with each of them that produce, you know, a series of hybrids. So we kind of came to the community with these options, you know, like what if it's a very thin flood wall purely engineered? What if it's a wall that becomes a bench? What if we incorporate other elements into that? What if the wall becomes actually a subtle undulating landscape? What if we actually take the highway and bury it under this landscape to create the elevation? What if we add bridges? And so we found that in places some things worked and in other places other things worked. And we really just kind of worked with the community through these design workshops the same way we work in the office.
And for specifics of architecture, one of Big's directives is one simple, strong move to create a strong impact. Could you tell us how you've applied this concept to the Big U?
It's a good point. I mean, I think we've tried really wherever possible to be as simple as possible, you know? If you find a park and it doesn't have very good connections to the neighborhood that lies across the highway from it, you build some bridges. And if you have a landscape that can come up to meet those bridges, they work very well together. To make those connections as blatant as possible from the city to the water, we extend the bridges all the way through to the water and create a series of waterfront activity points, sort of along the same rhythm of the Manhattan grid. So I think everywhere, sort of the big idea is to allow the city to function and for sort of urban life to function, not only in spite of, but enabled by this resiliency infrastructure.
That was Monocle's Nick Wager speaking to Kai Uwe Bergman, business partner at Big Architects in New York. And now back to London to look at another book launched this week. Type Plus is the latest offering to come from one of our favourite publishers, influential typographic specialists, Unit Editions. This brash book clearly aims to be startlingly contemporary, and like previous editions from Unit, clearly demonstrates the power of typography. Type Plus, however, takes this further by looking at the combined punch of type plus imagery. At the book's launch, which seemed to double up as a typography social, a panel of contemporary designers and typographers discussed some of the delights and dangers in their field, and also met Monocle contributor Hayley Ott, who brings us this report.
Over the past 20 years, typography has grown from an elite subject into something accessible to almost any person with a computer. New softwares have made it relatively easy to design a typeface, and a global community of typographers has developed, of people designing typefaces from their homes for the pleasure of it, for themselves. But typography remains an important element of commercial graphic design, and is the subject of two new books called Type Only and Type Plus. Here's Tony Brook, who designed the books as part of publishing house Unit Editions.
The idea that people would, all over the globe, would be sitting in their bedrooms playing around with typography and making striking images would have been laughable. When I was at college, typography was a thing to be endured. It wasn't playtime, it was, which, you know, I think there are two sides to typography. You know, it's just about embracing the other side. I like my rigorous typography, I like my legible typography, but I also love the idea that people can smash it up and break it and, you know, splatter it all over the walls and play with it. So I'm happy with both states of affairs.
Designer Adrian Shaughnessy is also part of Unit Editions.
It's hard to be a graphic designer and not have typography as your building blocks, the core elements of your work. You can be a typographer and not call yourself a graphic designer. You would then be engaged in something like designing the insides of books or specialist things like timetables or scientific publications. But most graphic designers are also typographers, and you would be a slightly odd graphic designer if typography wasn't at the core of what you do. The classical view of typography is that it should be invisible. You should read the text, you should read the words, absorb the meaning, and never have to think about the lettering. That has all changed, and there was a real big thing happened in the 80s when 80s and also into the 90s, where there became almost like a sort of cult of typography. Suddenly ordinary people knew about typefaces, and then that's even gone to another level now where everybody has a PC, everybody has a computer, they can draw down typefaces, they know about typefaces, they know the names of lots of them. So I think it's always existed, but it's reached a kind of almost a sort of fever pitch now. In the 80s, there was people like Neville Brody discovered that you could use type as an expressive medium. I mean, other people have done it. He wasn't the first. And then quite recently, in the last 10 years or so, there's been a movement away from elaborate typography back to a sort of austere purity and using typefaces that are almost undesigned. So I think typography is a perpetual pendulum that swings between extremes. I would only say that now we've reached a kind of period of sort of superabundance when basically anything goes.
Hugo Tim is a designer with London-based graphic design practice, Julia.
As a graphic designer, it's a very nice area to investigate because it can be split into two different things. One is visual aspect, which is shapes, aesthetic, formally how it looks, which is quite nice to work with. It's our area, is what we do. But every time you're just doing something with type and you're interfering with it, you're not interfering with only one thing. It's not like if you get a circle, then you make a triangle. They're just shapes. They don't mean anything. A circle, circle, triangle, triangle. But an A is an A. A B, they say stuff. So it's quite nice because it allows you to operate in more than one level. And that's quite exciting for a designer to do because of computer, internet, blah, blah, blah. You can do stuff. Now, just because you can do it doesn't mean you should do it. And that's a big difference, because we could design a typeface for every project we're in. Let's do a typeface for this, let's do a typeface. You can do that. It's possible with time-wise, budget-wise, it's good. But the judgment why doing it, I wouldn't say it's ethical or anything, or It could be a personal reason, it could be taste, it could be like, because you got this thing that you're really into right now that you want to do and you want to express, or because it can be good for the client, it could be good to give an identity to something. It's different reasons, but you cannot lose track of that. I can imagine that people do it as a hobby because they like. They do it as some people like drawing chairs. They just keep doing it. It's fine. But when you apply that to a commercial enterprise where there is, you have to kind of respond to a certain thing and deliver a certain, then you kind of need to not lose track why you're doing that thing. And the reasons are quite different. It's not always the same why you decide to do it.
Again, Tony Brook of Unit Editions.
When we're talking about typography, we're talking about type as image rather than type as carrier of content. It's more figurative, it's more expressive. There's just more opportunity and more possibilities with things the way they are now.
That was Monocle contributor Hayley Ott speaking to Tony Brook and some of the other typographers at the launch of Type Plus by Unit Editions here in London.
Grundig believes that television should provide more than entertainment. They should connect you with your world. Its state-of-the-art smart LED TVs allow you to unite with friends via Skype, watch over a sleeping child next door with baby cam, or control access to the internet through your mobile phone. Grundig is committed to investing in the best technology, digital innovation, and superlative design to help you bond with the world from your own home. Grundig. Supreme engineering, timeless design.
And to end the show, we go to the shores of the Danube and to Serbia's capital. Last week, Belgrade enjoyed its annual Design Week, a key event on the calendar in Southeast Europe. There's the usual mix of international local delegates and lecturers, enjoying all the sunny autumn delights that Serbia's capital has to offer, as well as presenting fresh ideas in architecture, product design and brand management. But this year, much of the intersession chatter was focused on the host city itself. Belgrade is facing its most radical redesign in decades, with a controversial riverfront development that could change the look of a huge chunk of the city centre. The Belgrade waterfront project is funded by the UAE with a developer from Dubai. But is it the right look for this ancient Balkan capital? Our correspondent Guy Delaunay has been testing the water with Belgrade Design Week delegates and other interested parties.
Well, there's a buzz of caffeine, conversation and creativity here in the coffee bar at Belgrade Design Week 2014. And this year's edition is being held in an abandoned glass factory in the centre of the old town. Now, there are many such buildings like this, not just in the city centre, but all around Belgrade. Relics of the former Yugoslavia, more prosperous times for this city. And the question now is, what should the city do to become prosperous in the future? That's one of the things which was addressed at one of the sessions of this conference on democracy and urban development. And it's a big question for Belgrade at the moment because we're facing the biggest redesign the city's seen in many decades, the extremely controversial Belgrade waterfront project. And the question is whether people have really been consulted enough over such a huge shift in what the city centre might look like.
As an idea to come down to the water, it's great. But as an architect, I would do more open spaces and try to pull back the offices and the big buildings. So to do it more public friendly.
Not consulting the experts in the field specifically is wrong. I mean, that's my personal opinion. And I think that's kind of what I've been hearing from a lot of colleagues.
This is one possible way of developing brownfield site, and the second one is typical real estate development, which attracts different kind of investments. So we have it all, and we have to like use all the resources.
This is what the fuss is all about. It's an area of Belgrade city centre called Savamala, and it wouldn't be uncharitable to say that it's a scruffy neighbourhood, all run-down shops, crumbling facades and heavy goods vehicles churning up the road surface. But the location is spectacular, right on the banks of the River Sava, by the confluence with the Danube, and the potential is huge. Now Serbia's government reckon they've got the key to unlock that, a €3 billion investment from the United Arab Emirates. But there's a lot of opposition.
the major complaint being about the lack of transparency or consultation in the process.
They wanted to put Belgrade down to the rivers, and now they will finally get it with the Belgrade on water, which is illusion. I mean, that will be so private and capital-owned that you could not just use the river as they refer at the beginning.
Iva Čukić is an architect and member of the Ministry of Space, a group which campaigns for the better use of public land and buildings.
What is the problem is the breaking the laws, breaking the constitution, economical issues, urban development issues, architectural issues. So it's very difficult to just explain it in some understandable way. And on the other side, you don't have any media coverage from the other side of the story. You don't have any architects in public talking about that. Have few, but they're in some smaller discussions or some internet portals, which is also not publicly presented.
The Belgrade waterfront project would transform Savamala. The main bus and railway stations would be moved and a skyscraper constructed on the riverbank. The proposed high-end retail and residential developments would completely change the character of the old neighbourhood. In all, it would be the greatest change to the city since the construction of New Belgrade almost 70 years ago. Iva's colleague and fellow architect Dobrica Veselinovic says that's too big a transformation to push through without a proper civic conversation.
If we have some project which is changing the shape and the image of the city, I think we should more involve people to say what they want in that part of city. We see now seeing the spaceship which is landed in some part of city, which nobody knows what it is, to whom it will serve, and what is the purpose of that. If we have example in Berlin that they made a city referendum what to do with the old airport, which is basically just the airport field of Tempelhof, why we don't have some similar initiatives in Belgrade, which is project with I don't know how 100 times more into the and money and the wideness of it.
Back at Belgrade Design Week, the city architect Milutin Folic mingled with the delegates every day, and he was happy to explain his stance on the Belgrade waterfront project. As far as he's concerned, it's simply the much-delayed realization of changes the city would have made long ago, but for the recent decades of turmoil.
The investor just gave its designer's touch with it, with one of the best practices in the world. And of course, every designer has a right to give some personal touch to it.
Milutin has heard all the complaints about the project, many of them in person at Belgrade Design Week, but he insists that the accusations of a lack of consultation are unfounded.
The whole thing is very, very transparent. What was prepared by the Urban Planning Institute is now in the public hearing. It's on the public display. Right now, you can, after this interview, you can actually go to the city assembly and take a look at it. And until the 29th of this month, you have a chance to submit your amendment, if you have some. All this we receive, we're going to consider. There is going to be a planning commission that's going to reconsider the whole thing after everything is being went through. Hopefully, the plan is by the end of the year going to be adopted by the government of Serbia.
Of course, there were plenty of experts at Design Week ready to pitch in with their opinions. Among them, a former Belgrade resident, now running his own business in Stuttgart, Miloš Dimčić of Architecture Programming.
Belgrade has beautiful rivers, two beautiful rivers, and I think even Corbusier said when he was here in Belgrade that it's one of the ugliest cities he saw on one of the most beautiful places that he saw. So they have to use that, and that's the river. So it's a great idea, but they have to approach it responsibly. They usually do surveys with people. That's like a standard process, and I think that's a very good thing. I don't know if they take that into consideration afterwards, but the city government should try to implement what people think and not what some foreign investors would like to see on the place. So the best thing is to take some time and survey people, and not only people, but the expert community, the architectural community that has to vote on it and discuss it before they do anything.
The future certainly looks shiny and bright on a Belgrade waterfront promotional video. It also looks rather more like Dubai than the eclectic mix of Habsburg, Ottoman and brutalist architecture that we've come to expect from Belgrade. And that's sure to keep the opposition, like the Ministry of Space Architects, keen to fight on.
There is a time to stop it. I'm 100% sure.
How?
We're working on it. Yeah.
Those sound like fighting words. Belgrade's waterfront transformation is far from a foregone conclusion. For Monocle, in Belgrade, I'm Guy Delaunay.
And that's all we've got time for in today's Section D. Today's show is produced by David Pleasant and edited by Alex Funnell. You can contact the producer, David, at dmp@monocle.com if you'd like to feature on the show or if you've got any comments or questions. I'm Tom Morris. And to play you out in a show dedicated to good things in the skies, here's Cloud Busting by Kate Bush. Thanks very much for listening. Bye-bye.
I still dream of Organon. I wake up crying. You're making rain and you're just in